And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. La 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 la. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Ahn, the Executive Director of the Korea Policy Institute. She has addressed Congress, the United Nations, and the National Human Rights Commission in South Korea, and has participated in several peace and humanitarian aid delegations to North Korea. She is the co-founder of the National Campaign to End the Korean War, Korean Americans for Fair Trade, and the Global Campaign to Save Jeju Island. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Ahn.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And the death of Kim Jong-il, who's referred to in North Korea as the dear leader, comes at an ironic time, does it not? Just as tensions between the U.S. and North Korea appear to be easing with an agreement signed this weekend in Beijing, the U.S. is expected to send 240,000 tons of food aid to North Korea in exchange for North Korea's agreement to suspend work on its nuclear enrichment program. How will the death of the dear leader affect this?
That is definitely the question of the day, Ian. And, what I fear is that the U.S. Intelligence community will kind of spin into what they did back in 1994 with the passing of Kim Jong-il's father, Kim Il-sung, for many, many years after Kim Il-sung's death. Much of the rhetoric and analysis coming out of Washington, D.C. Anticipated regime collapse, and which greatly influenced Washington and especially the White House decisions to on terms of U.S. policy. And we saw, in fact, U.S. policies shifting away from a potential breakthrough similar to what happened in 1994 with the agreed framework to a reversal of the policy of engagement towards essentially pursuing a regime change strategy, which is to further isolate North Korea, not send food aid when North Korea was on its knees begging for food aid, and intensifying sanctions against that country. So what Korean Americans, especially those who either have family in North Korea or South Korea, are hoping is, we can speculate all we want about what will happen in North Korea, but what we can try to influence is the way our country and our political leaders choose to engage with North Korea, and that's what we certainly can try to have some control over.
Well, I'm curious to know what the intelligence community knows about North Korea, given apparently that they only had a picture of the new leader, the 20-something-year-old son, Kim Jong-un. They only had a picture of him as a small schoolboy in Switzerland. So they don't really know much about this regime. In fact, nobody does, right?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I would probably be quoting correctly, would attribute to a statement from several CIA agents saying, we don't know anything about North Korea, in fact. The thing is, what we do know is probably a lot more information that has been gleaned in the past decade by a lot of humanitarian aid experts who have either visited the country regularly or who have been based in North Korea. So they actually have a lot of insight, as well as some of the statistics that have been gathered by a lot of the groups monitoring the humanitarian situation in North Korea. But you're right. I mean, we know very little. What we do know is that in some of the photos that have been taken of Kim Jong-il's visits preceding his passing, there have been a number of North Korean leaders representing the Workers' Party and the military who have accompanied him, which, you know, might signal to those watching from the outside that, you know, there is a steady and consistent committee, a political body, that will ensure the smooth transition of succession of power from Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un, the youngest son. So, but yes, I mean, again, this will all be conjecture because we just don't know enough. And but what we do know for sure with certainty is that pursuing peace, pursuing dialogue, pursuing engagement and reconciliation has actually proven to be very good for the people of North Korea in terms of their ability to access food, in terms of their ability to recalibrate from the devastated economy since the collapse of the socialist trading bloc. And it's good for the people in South Korea because they won't have to be in a constant state of alert and, you know, facing militarism that leads so much of their public dollars towards the financing of and preparation for war. So we know it's good for the people of North and South Korea, and it's good for regional stability. So hopefully the political leaders among the six-party talks countries will bear that in mind and pursue you know, a spirit of engagement and dialogue with North Korea.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Ahn, who's the Executive Director of the Korea Policy Institute. She participated in several peace and humanitarian aid delegations to North Korea and is the co-founder of the National Campaign to End the Korean War, Korean Americans for Fair Trade, and the Global Campaign to Save Jeju Island. Now, the conventional wisdom is now that the military will be the kind of power brokers and that the North Korean government may fall back into a kind of conservative reflex, if you will. During this transition period, already the military has, I mean, they're already on military alert. What's your sense of that idea that suggests that the son has not really consolidated his position and that he relies heavily on the military, not to mention Jang Sung-thaek, who's apparently the power behind the throne? Let's start with that question. What do you know about this eminence gris character that's referred to as Jang Sung-thaek?
You know, I don't know too much about him. I know that he's a brother-in-law to Kim Jong-il, and I know that he was appointed a general at the September conference, where Kim Jong-un, the son, was named the successor. So this is, again, since we don't completely know what is happening, is that what I can say based on the experience of the last major political transition that took place in 1994 with the passing of Kim Il-sung is that this country and its political leadership is used to these transitions. And for some time now, since 2008 at the very latest or the earliest, we've known about Kim Jong-il's deteriorating health. And so steps have been made by the country's leadership, which I believe includes, you know, a committee or several committees. There's clearly a well-oiled decision-making body that is going to ensure the smooth transition. Now, whether Kim Jong-un has the, you know, legitimacy in the eyes of the Korean people, I mean, who knows? Who knows any of this? But I have no doubt that we will see a period of stability, certainly in this period of great change and shock to the country, because they're used to it. And not only are they used to the political transitions, they're also used to pretty major shocks through the, you know, whether it's the collapse of the socialist trading bloc, whether it's the famine, or whether it's the nuclear crisis that they experienced with the United States. So, you know, I can't bet my life on it, but I can just tell by being an observer of North Korea and seeing just the country's ability to maintain stability amid tremendous turmoil and change that that they will be able to survive this period, and hopefully this will present some new opportunities for North Korea in terms of how the outside world will engage with North Korea, but also some of the political shifts that we're seeing taking place in South Korea towards a more progressive and liberal government, and just that the winds of change will be blowing towards more open, more democratic, and hopefully the peaceful reconciliation and gradual reunification of the country.
So the what about winds of change, though, Christine Ahn, in the north, which clearly would be welcome, surely. The North Korean news agency, official news agency, has called upon the Korean people and the military to revere the respected comrade Kim Jong-un. So what possible change would there be? And can you explain this kind of communist dynasty, if you will, and why this reverence and why the people crying in the streets?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's it's a phenomenon that even somebody like myself, who is trying to understand the North Korean mindset, I can probably hardly even start to scratch the surface. But I would say that Kim Jong-il's legacy is a mixed one. I mean, on the one hand, you have a situation in which he took over North Korea at a time of tremendous political turmoil. They were on a brink of war with the United States. That was under Bill Clinton. His father had. That was when Jimmy Carter had gone to North Korea at a time to essentially prevent the Clinton administration from essentially preemptively striking North Korea. So that was not only that occurring, but there was the collapse of the socialist trading bloc. So its historic trading partners, China, the Soviet Union, had disintegrated. So the whole economy started to unravel. And then not to mention, as we know, as progressives, so much of the economy is tied to energy, and North Korea has been very highly dependent on foreign imports of oil to maintain, I mean, just even the basic things such as running its tractors. So this, all of this kind of contributed to a massive food crisis and a famine that essentially killed up to 600,000 to up to 2 million people. I mean, it's hard to know what the exact figure is, but that is a significant percentage of the North Korean population. It has, it has had lasting scars on the people of North Korea. So you have all of this, and so Kim Jong-il assumes power amidst all of that, and he is in power, and he is unable to implement economic reforms that essentially returns the country to its state, from the preceding the 1980s, when North Koreans had a good quality of life. In fact, many will say that North Korea's economy far exceeded that of South Korea up until the late 1970s. And so he wasn't able to deliver in that sense, but I would say the kind of reverence has to do with the fact that Kim Jong-il was able to acquire a nuclear weapon. And I think that from the North Koreans' perspective, there's a certain kind of pride with that. And it hasn't to do with the fact that they want to use that nuclear weapon to terrorize the rest of the world, which is how it's perceived and portrayed in the Western and mainstream media. But it's that they can proudly claim it as a tool for self-defense. And that's where I think so much of the Korean, like understanding the Korean mindset, understanding the kind of political propaganda that has emerged from the last half century as a result of the direct, real and lived experience of the North Korean people, whether it was the experience of Japanese occupation and then followed by the division of the Korean Peninsula and then the brutal Korean War, where nearly 70% of that country was bombed to bits. You know, when I go to North Korea, there, I have this experience where one of the guides, you know, they would always point to this building in Pyongyang, and I would always be baffled, why are they so fascinated with this building? And in fact, it's because that was a restaurant that was one of the only standing buildings that survived the Korean War. I mean, otherwise, all the infrastructure in Pyongyang is virtually built in the post-war period. And so there is, you know, a certain kind of fierce mindset of the North Korean people that they want to be independent, they want to be sovereign, and in that sense, Kim Jong-il delivered. And so it is a mixed feeling, and I'm sure that the North Korean people are fatigued, and they're ready for better economic times. They're ready to have consistent food supplies. They're ready for a return to a life where they have regular sources of energy. And so, you know, but it's a complicated situation. And, but, you know, with the changing of hands, and we don't know much about Kim Jong-un, but what we do know is that he did study, you know, abroad. It sounds like he went to school in Switzerland. And, you know, he has an experience of what it's like to live outside of North Korea. And so hopefully that might also be a good thing, you know, to be a citizen of the international community and to help the country gradually move. But, you know, it takes two to tango. And, you know, the North Koreans have been wanting to engage with the global community and with the United States and to have normalized relations. So hopefully we'll see a reciprocation on this side of the Pacific Ocean.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Christine Ahn.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Ahn, who's Executive Director of the Korean Policy Institute. She has addressed Congress, the United Nations, and the National Human Rights Commission in South Korea and has participated in several peace and humanitarian aid delegations to North Korea. She's the co-founder of the National Campaign to End the Korean War, Korean Americans for Fair Trade, and the Global Campaign to Save Jeju Island. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking with an early critic of the Iraq reconstruction fiasco.